This is the time set for oral argument in PM Resources Group, LLC versus Nevada Association Servicers Incorporated. Is council ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may do so. Do you want to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, thank you. 3 minutes.
Okay, very well.
Thank you for that reminder. If it pleases the court, Michael Bone on behalf of Appellant Resources Group, trustee of the East Sunset Road Trust. What I would like the court to do with this case is to reaffirm its holding from the 1892 case of Dezet versus Landry that title at a foreclosure sale transfers at the time the winning bidder tenders his money and the money is accepted by the foreclosure trustee. I'd also like the court to rule that the burden of proof of payment was on Hydrodynamic, not on the plaintiff and appellant resources group, specifically on this issue. I would like the court to rule that the burden of showing that the payment was received before the auction, that burden should be on Hydrodynamic, not on the appellant here. The district court, I respectfully submit, wrongfully placed the burden on the plaintiff appellant and not on Hydrodynamic. And I would also like the court to rule that the burden of showing an entitlement to equitable relief was on Hydrodynamic and that Hydrodynamic failed to meet its burden of proof.
We do not have a determination by the district court that your client was a bona fide purchaser for value, do we?
That finding was not made. However, the respondent in their brief acknowledges that my client was not aware of any payment until after he received a phone call from the representative of NAS 4 days after the sale.
Right, but just to confirm, we do not have a finding of BFP status.
Correct.
Thank you.
However, there is no evidence that my client knew of anything. On the first issue I just mentioned, this court in 1890.
Wait, but let's pause on that. I'm sorry, just a moment. Your client paid $350 for property worth $1 million and within 24 hours of the sale was protesting that the property was worth $1 million such that the only way to unwind this would be a payment in that amount to your client, correct?
The sale was on Friday, February 13th, which was the Friday before the three-day President's Day weekend, and he did not learn of any issues until the following Tuesday.
Okay.
And that's when he protested and said, you already have my money, but I have title to the property. If you want the property back, it's worth $1 million. I want $1 million.
And where I'm heading, I'm not trying to cross-examine you, but I'm trying to articulate the standard for equitable relief on these foreclosure sales. And I recognize there's been a lot of argument over Shadowwood and the restatement and what you look at in setting aside a foreclosure sale. But even a disparity in price versus fair market value that is greater than, it's not the below 20% that the restatement had in it and that became a subject of debate for a little while. This is 35% of fair market value. But isn't that something that may mitigate against a finding of...
I would respectfully say no, because there has to be fraud, oppression, or unfairness in addition to an unreasonably low price. There's no evidence of fraud, oppression, or unfairness, and no finding that the price was unreasonably low.
And counsel, I understand your position to be, from the way you frame the issues, that the moment the sale was cried under NRS 116.31164, subsection 3, you were entitled, before you get into any equitable analysis, to a deed.
Correct. I mean, the case law from 1892 is title transferred when the money is paid and accepted by the trustee at the foreclosure sale. And that's our position. At that time, title transferred, and we're the owner.
Did the district
that would shift the burden to the other side to
prove. Did the district court address that statute or its implication as part of its determination?
I do not believe it did. I will point out that this is a commercial property. It's not a residence. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it's not subject to Chapter 116, because 116 specifically excludes commercial properties, unless the CC&Rs incorporate 116. And the only part of 116 that is incorporated in the CC&Rs are the foreclosure statutes of 116.3162 through 31164.
In this case?
In this case.
Yeah.
And it's acknowledged by both sides that those are the only statutes incorporated into the CC&Rs.
But to go further on questioning you, I don't want to take up all your argument, but it concerned me also that the district court made a finding that the payment, the check that had been mailed by Mr. Patterson's client, that it arrived at the NAS's office on or before the time and date of the sale.
The court ruled that it was our burden to show that the check did not get there before the sale. And I respect the...
Is that an irregularity? I mean, the court's finding, let's say I credit that finding, is that an irregularity that combined with the price discrepancy would merit setting the sale aside?
No. First of all, the notice of sale contains statutory language. And the statutory language says, unless you pay the amount specified in this notice before the sale date. That would be February 12th. The next sentence says, and before the sale date, you can lose your home even with the sales, you must act before the sale date. And this is, you know, the statute requires specific language, bold letters, 14 point, which this has, and it says before the sale date. It's undisputed. The check did not come in before the sale date. I'll also point out that payment is an affirmative defense under Rule 8C of the Rules of Civil Procedure. It must be pled, and every element of the affirmative defense must be pled and proven, and the burden of proof is on the party asserting that affirmative defense. So when the judge placed the burden upon my client, it was contrary to the requirements of Rule 8C. And for that reason, I respectfully submit that the district court ruled erred in putting the burden upon my client. I would also say that because they did not comply with the statutory language of the notice of sale and provide the payment prior to that date, that they are not entitled to equitable relief because they did not comply with the notice of sale and the requirements of the notice of sale. Notice of sale also requires cash or cashier's check. This is a personal or business check that was sent. It wasn't a cash or cashier's check. Oh, I will acknowledge the district court did not make that finding, but it's clear from the record looking at the check, it is not a cashier's check.
Mr. Brum, what's the position on the standard of review? You're indicating this Rule 8C issue is a legal issue as far as the burden of proof, and I understand that argument.
Correct.
As far as the other factual findings made by the judge, is it a deferential standard we have to give, or is there an argument that we can review it de novo, or what's your position on that as far as this equitable relief type of case? Because this is the wrinkle in this case is a little bit different than most of the ones we get.
Mm-hmm. You know, prior to the trial, the parties stipulated virtually all the facts, many of which are in the findings. And the fact that was not stipulated to and was put into issue by both parties was, when was the check received? And we've always been of the opinion it's absolutely irrelevant because they did go forward with the sale. The owner of the property did not take proper steps to make sure the sale was stopped.
What's the standard of review? How should we analyze it? If you were right in our decision, I don't know you'd win, but what would your standard of review would you put in there?
I think it's deferential, but I will acknowledge that the, you know, if it's supported by substantial evidence, you have to uphold it. I respectfully submit it's not substantial evidence. There was a conflict.
Okay.
You know, and the my client did testify. Sale was over, he walked out the door, and as he's walking out the door, he saw the mailman walking in. The judge did not find, said he was credible, but said he was mistaken. The only other evidence was the testimony of Chris Jurgensen, who testified that mail normally comes between 9:30 and 11:30, sometimes as late as noon. But again, because the payment was accepted, the sale went forward, it didn't come the day before as required by the statute, and because the burden is on Hydrodynamic to show the payment, and also the burden is on them to show they are entitled to equitable relief, that's really not an issue.
The burden of proof on those issues is a legal question.
Correct. But the finding as to when the check came in, I submit, is really not an issue here because the burden is on them, and the burden is on them to show equitable relief. And they acknowledge in their brief the man just dropped the check in the mail. He did not send it. He could have driven it across town and dropped it off personally. He could have given it to FedEx or UPS and said, get it there tomorrow and give me some tracking information to show it got there. He could have placed they acknowledge he didn't even pick up the phone to call to say, the check's in the mail. Did you get the check? What can I do to stop this? He did none of that.
So, Mr. Bowen, the only finding the court makes on the check is number 28, at least its arrival. The only finding the court can make is that it arrived between 9:30 and 11 on the 13th. That's not before the sale. That's after the sale or on the day of the sale. But it's not before the sale. That's a legal issue, isn't it?
The finding was the sale commenced at 10 o'clock, was over by approximately 10:30, but I do agree with you. It's a legal issue at this point when the check was supposed to come. I would submit that the statutory language that's in the notice of sale says the day before, so we don't have issues such as this one.
You agree that if the check had arrived the day before, we would affirm?
Yes, but there's no finding in the check arrived the day before.
I'm not saying there's evidence for that.
If the check was there the day before, we wouldn't be here. Okay. Absolutely. My time is about up. Unless you have any question, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Surely. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Jeff Patterson. If it pleases the court, Jeff Patterson on behalf of Hydrodynamic. Your Honor, what we're really doing here today is making a determination of whether we're going to deprive a company in this case, although a company that's owned by a single individual, whether we're going to deprive that company of real property on a debt of about $6,500 under questionable circumstances. And I know this case is different from a lot of the HOA cases that you've heard before. This case is the real owner of the property. It's not banks that have foreclosed or banks that are fighting their lien priority issues. There's no lender involved. My client owned this property free and clear. The property, by, I believe, Judge Becker's determination, is worth at least $1 million.
So you did receive the excess proceeds?
I'm sorry?
You did receive the excess proceeds.
Well, we haven't received anything, Your Honor, because...
You're entitled to the proceeds.
My client would be entitled to the excess
proceeds. Am I correct that your client would be entitled to the proceeds in excess of $6,500?
Yes, Your Honor, you are correct. Okay. You are correct.
And that would amount to something in the neighborhood of $344,000, $45,000.
That'd be correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And what's more, this case is different because it actually went to trial, where the judge listened and heard the testimony of the witnesses, examined the evidence, and issued an opinion. And really what it came down to is a balancing of equities. And I think the foreclosure statutes try to balance the equities of debtors to be protected from wrongful foreclosures and to be protected from loss of the property, and for creditors to have inexpensive and efficient methods of foreclosing on properties. I wish the facts in this case were a lot cleaner than they are. We are stuck with what they are. My client received the notice of the foreclosure sale. When he received the notice, he prepared a check. He deposited it in the mail on February 6th, with a foreclosure sale date of February 13th.
What is the effect of language in the notice that says that the payment must be made before the sale?
Well, Your Honor, I heard the exchange about being the day before the sale. The payment for a debt to be foreclosed on, the debt has to be valid and outstanding at the time of the sale. And if payment is made of that debt, even minutes before the sale, the debt is extinguished.
So where's the burden to show the payment was made?
Well, this is a quiet title action, Your Honor, where Mr. Bowen's client is claiming title, that he's entitled to the property. And under Nevada case law, the burden of showing you're entitled to property is the party claiming quiet title.
But don't you bear the burden, or your client bear the burden, to demonstrate that payment was made so that there was no debt owing at the time of the sale?
Well, even if that's the case, Your Honor, the findings in this case, again, testimony of witnesses, including Mr. Jurgensen from Nevada Association Services, his testimony was when the mail arrived. I believe Judge Becker determined, or in her findings and in the judgment in this case, stated, I am not certain exactly when it did arrive. But
so if the sale were cried at 9:30, then that would have been good enough to demonstrate that payment was made. What if it was received at 10 o'clock and the sale was cried at 9:15? I mean, we're down to minutes here. That's why I asked the question about the legal effect of the notice. The notice says the day before the sale. Does it not?
The notice does say that, Your Honor.
So what is the legal significance of that language in the notice? Because the finding of the judge is it didn't happen the day before the sale. It happened the day of the sale, that is, the check arriving.
That is true. That is the finding of the judge, Your Honor. I would suggest that the expediency of having the notice being the day before the sale is to prevent the situation that we're in right here. However, as I said before, payment extinguishes the debt. And you can't foreclose on an extinguished debt.
I guess, forgive me, I don't mean to be pestering you at this same point, but it seems like it's significant if there is legal significance in the notice that payment must be made the day before the sale. Is that just language in notice as a matter of convenience to try to avoid problems like this? Or does that language bear legal significance? Suppose that the payment were received and everybody agreed that she was received at 12:01 on February 13th as opposed to 11:59 on February the 12th. Would there have been a legal significance to that?
Well, Your Honor, it seems to me that if there was a legal significance to that date, it would be emphasized by the legislature in the statute. Mm-hmm. This provision is to give notice in large type to the debtor that the debtor has a responsibility if the debtor wants to prevent foreclosure of his property to take action.
Doesn't the statute require that notice and its form?
The statute does require the notice and its form, Your Honor. Okay. But the legislature does not go on to say specifically that any payment must be made that the day before the sale.
I think that's
I believe that would abrogate existing case law on the extinguishment of a debt.
So, Mr. Patterson, again, listening to all this, I think this burden of proof might be a critical issue with the result of the case, what we do with it. So you're saying because Mr. Bowen's client filed the quiet title action, it's their burden on this issue of when the payment was received. And I think he's saying under NRCP 8C, it's a mandatory affirmative defense, so it's in which the defendant has the burden of proof.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Your Honor, I would note that Mr. Bowen's allegation on NRCP 8 was not made at trial. There's nothing in the record that this was made at trial at all.
Okay.
And quite frankly, it was made in the reply brief for before Your Honor.
Okay.
The first time I saw that issue was in the reply brief.
I see.
Obviously, after I had already submitted my...
So you're saying it was never made in the trial?
The first time it was brought up was in the reply brief, and then your oral argument, Your
Honor. But not, it was never brought up at the trial?
It was not brought up at trial, Your Honor.
What about the question of who had the burden of proof?
I don't think that... My recollection from the trial, Your Honor, was that there was not a lengthy discussion about burden of proof, and I believe in the judgment and in the minute order, Judge Becker found that the burden was on the plaintiff in this case.
Because as the proponent of the quiet title action, I mean, that's conventional, I get it, but he's making a different argument now.
Well, that wasn't the discussion that we had during, my recollection is during the during thing. And I would recommend to you is not only the judgment in this case sets forth the court's reasoning, but at the conclusion of the trial for closing argument, which I believe begins on about page 413 of the record, Judge Becker does an extensive discussion, questioning counsel and with counsel, about various issues in the case, including the burden of proof and what the judge is thinking.
So she puts her reasoning on the record on that?
Yes. I believe it's almost 30 pages of the record that is the exchange with Judge Becker and counsel about her various thoughts on the issues in this case.
Do you ascribe any significance to the fact that the deed was never delivered?
Well, I do, Your Honor, because I think that the trustee conducted the sale, and it's the trustee's obligation to deliver the deed upon an appropriate, valid sale. And the trustee in this case has determined that the sale was not valid because of the uncertainty of whether or not payment was received prior to the sale being completed.
And so, as I understand it, it's when the payment is made that ordinarily the right to have the deed is determined, yet here the trustee refused to deliver the deed. So is there a dispute between the plaintiff and the trustee, or does that implicate the validity of your client's title?
Well, certainly there's a dispute between the plaintiff and the trustee, and I believe the first claim for relief in the complaint was for specific performance that the trustee delivered the deed.
Is there damage? The trustee was a party to this case, but didn't file any brief on this appeal. Is that your understanding of this?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And is there a default against the trustee, or is the...
The trustee participated at trial.
Okay.
It just has not participated in the appeal, Your Honor.
Okay.
It certainly would have been helpful, but the trustee chose not to do that. One other thing I do want to address briefly. There's been a lot made in this case about my client's method of payment of the obligation. And again, this was approximately $6,500 of delinquent association fees against a property worth about $1 million, at least as the record indicates. And the record shows that my client did not have this building as his primary business location. He had a different building where his business was located, and really didn't check mail at this location. And it appears that any mail regarding the association's claims was sent to this location. He became aware of the deficiency and the pending sale when I believe a process server actually delivered a notice to the property, and he happened to be at the property. And the notice, of course, statutory notice, says you must do something. Well, he did something. He went to his office, he wrote a check a week before the day of the sale, and he deposited it in the main post office in Las Vegas to deliver it on Desert Inn Road was the address for Nevada Association Services. I can only speculate, Your Honor, what happened between the date that that was mailed and not being delivered prior to February 13th. Certainly it was my client's intent that the lien be paid. And much has been made about that he could have done a better job. That's true. He could have done a better job. He could have hand-delivered it, if he'd asked me, which he didn't. He could have hand-delivered it, obtained a receipt with a copy of the check. That's what I'd advise. But I think the thing with the whole concept that he didn't do things right or could have done a better job is, as lawyers, and as all of us are fairly long practicing lawyers, we've been educated and we've been trained and we have, more, probably most importantly, experience on trying to avoid situations just as this. And I certainly would have advised any client to, at a very minimum, have some form of tracking on an important payment such as this one. But I think in our positions as lawyers and the experiences we've had, we forget thinking of the layperson. And Mr. Guzman in this case, and I believe that his testimony is in the record, supports that, simply was, I was informed I owed this money, I wrote a check, it was being delivered right here in Las Vegas, it was due a week later, I put it in the United States mail, believing that the U.S. Postal Service would timely deliver that with the next business day or two across town.
Mr. Patterson, may I ask? I didn't want to interrupt it because you're making an important point there. Had you concluded? Because I wanted to ask you a separate question.
Your Honor,
In paragraph 14 of the court's conclusions of law, it is clear, at least it appears clear to me, that a key to the judge's decision was stated as follows. As well as recognizing the legislature intended to allow for the payment of community liens post-sale by right of redemption, I'm assuming that the judge there is referring to such things as mechanics liens, tax liens where redemption privileges exist. Is that appropriate reasoning in the context of a sale which is governed by the CCNRs under Chapter 116, which has no redemption period?
Your Honor, if I may speculate, this is...
Well, first of all, do you agree with me that nothing in 116 that is incorporated in the CCNRs extends a right of redemption to your client?
As of the date of the sale, the statute did not provide for redemption.
Okay, so you were about to comment.
My comment simply, Your Honor, is as you know, in 2015, the legislature revised Chapter 116 to provide for right of redemption. When I read this, my thought was Judge Becker read the current version of the statute.
Yeah.
Not fully realizing that the statute had been amended after the date of the sale.
It would appear as though that might have factored into her equitable decision.
It may have, and it may have simply been, Your Honor, and I'm sorry my time has passed, and is it okay if I proceed?
Yeah, please answer.
It may have been, Your Honor, that, and again, I can only speculate, in light of the legislature changing the law to provide for a right of redemption, that the court looked at that as being part of the equitable consideration in determination to void the sale.
And perhaps the transcript citation that you offered in 419 or whatever it is helpful here, but I am struck by the fact that it's a commercial piece of property. I get that it took 116 into it via the CCNRs, not all of 116, but several sections of it. But to me, you have an owner of the property who is not a lender, who is a business person, not in the business of lending and so on. And so it's a very different environment than the classic HOA bank collection setting, and in terms of the equities involved here. And I was wondering when I read it whether or not that was what Judge Becker was getting at. Is there any discussion of that in this record at all? In other words, the different parties, you started your comments with that. I don't know if that can make a legal difference, but it might make an equitable one.
I don't recall Judge Becker having a discussion about the different, for example, in Shadowwood, where the parties were lenders that were kind of fighting it out. I don't recall her making any distinction between.
Should that make a difference? I mean, I'm not sure that it should.
I think when you're looking at equity, which I like to believe it's kind of like the law doing the right thing, that could be a consideration of that this is, you know, with the totality of the circumstances. The good faith effort of the client to try to pay, again, maybe not doing the best job, but having the desire that this debt be paid and that the sale not go forward, you know, the nature of the property. I did not argue in this case that the price was shockingly low, because I don't think under the standards of the court's previous decisions it is.
Okay.
But it is. In balancing equities, it is a huge financial loss for, you know, a businessman compared to a fairly modest lien claim.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Could you add 3 minutes to Mr. Baum's time?
And Mr. Brown, if you'd comment, too, about if you raise that 8C argument in the district court that you've made here today, where it was raised, you know, so we can...
record. Burden of proof argument from Rule 8 was raised in response to their argument in their answering brief that we had the burden of proof. So they raised it in their answering brief, so we responded to that in our reply brief.
Okay.
Your Honor... earlier asked me if there was a finding of a bona fide purchaser. A lot of reading, you prepare for these things. There is a finding of a bona fide purchaser, paragraph 9 of the findings. Resources group bid and tendered money without knowledge of the possible irregularity cure of a default by arrival of check. Thus, it would arguably hold the status of bona fide purchaser for value if the check arrived after the sale. That status is not affected by the general knowledge that sales can sometimes be invalidated or set aside. Now, there's four factors from Shadowwood to be considered: price, presence of fraud, oppression, or unfairness, the action or inaction of the owner of the property or the person affected, and the presence of a bona fide purchaser. And the court says bona fide purchaser. The court in number 12 says it's more than 20%. It's not unreasonably low. Paragraph 13, no evidence the price was affected with unfairness, fraud, or oppression. So they have no factors in their favor. When counsel is arguing about the equities, he's arguing about money. He says it's unfair to deprive a client of a $1 million property for only $350,000. Justice Hardis, he was correct. He is going to get the excess proceeds. This isn't one of those cases where my client came in and bid just pennies over the amount. This is a substantial payment. And Your Honor has already decided the it's not fair for a low price argument in SFR. Because the lien is so small, because the remedy is so simple, he's the master of his own destiny. All he has to do is timely write the check and timely make sure that it's properly delivered, which he did not do, and they acknowledge it. He didn't even pick up the phone. I mean, to mail an envelope is only 49 cents. To give it to FedEx is an extra $20. Phone calls are free. He didn't even do that. And because of that, and you compare that with the bona fide purchaser. What did my client do wrong? He was unaware of this. They have nothing to show that my client knew of anything that was wrong or any irregularities or my client acted unreasonably or anything. He's just an innocent purchaser who came, tendered his money. They took the check. Respectfully submit, at that time he became the owner, and without grounds for equitable relief, and there are no grounds for equitable relief here, we're done.
To the burden of proof issue, the judge's conclusion number 14
yes.
says, however, Resources Group, that's your client, has not demonstrated the check did not arrive prior to the sale. So there's no question that that was the judge perceived that was your responsibility to demonstrate.
Correct.
All right. Mr. Patterson was commenting about the exchange that occurred in closing argument. Do you have a recollection of the exchange that you had with Judge Becker at 413 in the record when you were conducting closing arguments, and whether this burden of proof question came up in that discourse?
I do not have that recollection.
Okay.
I apologize for that.
That's all right.
The question of the burden of proof has come up in a number of cases, and last November, the Shadow Canyon case kind of clarified it and said that the burden of sale, presumption is in favor of the record title holder. Now here, my title transferred to my client when the money was paid, but it wasn't of record. As I would respectfully submit, we can fudge this a little bit and say because my client did pay the money, he becomes the title holder and the burdens and the presumptions go in his favor. There is also the statutory presumption that the foreclosure sale did comply with Chapter 116's provisions. That's 47.250 subsection 16, providing for a rebuttable presumption that the law has been obeyed. So we do believe that the fact the sale, the money did not come in the day before the sale as required by the notice. My client paid the money was accepted, they are going to get excess proceeds, that you should find in favor of my client. The question was asked of Mr. Patterson about the fact that the deed was not delivered. I cited the Inouye Grant case, which summarized a lot of older Nevada cases, and they note in there that some of the older Nevada cases talking about trust deed foreclosures say that the delivery of a deed is simply a ministerial act. Chapter 107 has since been modified, but this isn't a Chapter 107. So the holdings of this court that the delivery of the deed is simply a ministerial act, I would submit, has no effect on the validity of the title of my client to this property. And for these reasons, I respectfully would request that you reverse the finding of the district court and rule that title is with my client and that he is entitled to a deed that he can record and make the world know that he's the owner of this property. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This matter will